Right, welcome to this Sunday afternoon meeting of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. I'm pleased to introduce Glenn Morris.
What I'd like to do is start by asking if anyone here isn't a member of the Socialist Party. One, two, oh, okay, three, four, five, quite a few people, that's interesting. Okay, well, that's actually quite useful. I was rather thinking that probably, after my last talk I gave here, that almost everybody would be. And thereby, I think, lies a problem, because when one just talks about socialism, you're often talking to people who have already come across it and they're engaged with the idea, so you kind of feel like you're pushing, if you want to call it that, against an open door, which is not terribly helpful. I think one of the great things that socialists can do is convey and communicate these ideas with other people. I mean, that's the key thing. So what I kind of would like to look at is when one discusses these issues with other people, and that might be a cab driver, it might be with friends, it might be with a family, work colleagues, or someone you just meet in the street. When you're discussing these ideas, why do we get the reactions we get? And I'm not an expert, I'm not a psychologist, but I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and I would like to just perhaps put forward some ideas to you, particularly socialists, funnily enough, who may want to take them on board or not, in terms of thinking about how one couches conversation and with other people when talking about socialism. One of the things I find when I do talk to people is certain reactions, and they're very predictable sometimes, and often they can be extremely hostile. And the hostility of the reaction is often where people get quite angry, quite frustrated, sort of you can sense this palpable annoyance in their voice when you're talking about ideas that, after all, I think there'd be little dispute, are good ideas. They're ways of dealing with people and society that will make things better for everyone. So what is it about the conveyance of those sorts of ideas that make people angry? And that's kind of where this title came from. So what people often say to you when you discuss this sort of thing with them is, oh my God, you know, that's utopia. You know, well, you begin to think, well, yes, what is wrong with that? You know, why do people rail against this idea of utopia? And when one looks up utopia, you find in the dictionary definition is a perfect place or state of things. Utopian, as a word, tends to be idealistic. So they will say, oh, it's utopian, and that kind of changes the nuance of the whole meaning, because then it becomes idealistic. So what they're saying to you then is, oh, it would never happen. And of course, that is something they do often say. Incidentally, it would be helpful. Last time I gave a talk, or at least one or two times ago, it was suggested that I was showing my holiday snaps. I don't want you to think that this time, because I've limited it. There are far fewer pictures. But what may be of some use is if you can all at least see that, because some of the pictures may be relevant. Well, I hope they're all relevant, really, to be honest with you. So what do people say? When you talk to them, they say, oh, it's idealistic. They also say one classic thing people say is that people are naturally selfish. And I can come on to that later, but I think there's plenty of evidence to show that that clearly isn't the case. Another thing people say is, oh, it's always been like that. So this kind of an acceptance of the current system that suggests it's always been like this, and what right have we got to even suggest otherwise? That I often come across in arguments with other people. Another one, it'll never change. Well, of course, it won't change unless people start to develop their ideas, and that is accepted. It will never change unless the person you're talking to starts to think differently and then talks to other people. It'll never work, or it wouldn't work, is another common one. And again, this is all this kind of preconceived ideas of what this, why it wouldn't work, and how they perceive this developing. The other thing I think that socialists struggle with, and I'm happy to be shot down for this, but I do think it needs airing, and that is socialism as a word or concept, I think, is to some degree is a struggle unless you really have looked into it and understood what it means. Now, I suspect most people here have looked into it, but those that haven't may well think of Gordon Brown. They may well think of France. They may well think of National Socialism. They think of all sorts of things as socialism. Often they think of communism. So they think of Russia, and they think of all these other sorts of political systems. So therein lies a slight problem. And obviously when you are discussing this sort of thing, with socialism, with other people, one has to begin on by explaining that their idea of socialism, and this is often the case, is not your idea or our idea of socialism. So you're straight away kind of developing a conflict there, because what then happens is you find yourself questioning their intelligence often. So if they think socialism is one thing, you say, well, no, it's not. I'm right, you're wrong. So you kind of developed a conflict before you've even started. Now, I think that is a problem. I'm not going to try and give an answer for it now because there's not time. But I do think this sort of thing needs thinking about when one is conveying ideas. Because if the socialism is so wonderful, isn't this place packed? Why don't we have to buy a much bigger premises, a huge hall, and the meetings are increasing and increasing and increasing? Why is that? I think because people have this perception of what socialism is, and I think there's a bit of a stumbling block there. I've mentioned early the anger of people when presented with these ideas. I had a pint with someone the other day, and we were discussing politics, and this chap, I was putting the socialist case, and this chap got definitely very angry. And I felt, well, this is peculiar, because you're saying, talking about a world that is better for people, where life will be more comfortable for all people and not just the few, and yet this chap got terribly angry with this, terribly, terribly angry, and I just couldn't quite understand why. So I began to think of these things, and this what led, as I say, to this idea of the course. That's the talk. What I would also say is that when people talk to you, when you're putting the socialist case, what often happens as well, some people are quite sympathetic. And you find that my wife is a good example of this. She will be very sympathetic to these ideas. And she's telling you, yes, that's really good. But then what would happen about this? And what often their argument, you can see that they can kind of appreciate what you're thinking and so on. But they then give arguments based on what I would call capitalist conditioning. So I tried to think on the train over today how I could explain this, and I hope I make a half-decent job of it, but it's very important when you're arguing with people, because you have to be able to recognise that if they're arguing back, they're actually arguing about how people would behave, but in a capitalist system. So they think that people would carry on behaving how they do in a capitalist system, in a socialist system. An example might be, okay, why doesn't everybody if you have your socialism, why doesn't everyone go out and get, you know, a Rolls Royce? Would be a sort of typical example of that. Well, the fact is simple. Under capitalism, and this is a simplistic response, but it gives the picture, I hope, and as an example. Under capitalism, a Rolls Royce says something about the person that drives it. It tells you probably they're pretty wealthy. Probably they want to make quite a big statement about themselves, and they probably don't care much about how much fuel they use, and there's probably lots of other things. But the thing is, in capitalism, it gives them a lift. People think, oh, he's got a Rolls Royce, he must be wealthy, he must do this, that, and the other. And so therefore, he is kind of made out to be slightly different. And in socialist society, of course, you could probably have a big fat car if you wanted one, but you wouldn't be respected for it, or you wouldn't be held up, and it wouldn't have the same kudos. And I think that's the key thing that one has to look at when talking to people, is if you are arguing with them, you have to be able to pick up when they're arguing a case against socialism, but using what I call capitalist conditioning. So they're kind of giving you an argument that would only actually be true if it was still capitalism. And that's quite a key point, I think. Anyway, so what is capitalism? Now, I don't want to dwell hugely on detail, because very often we all get bogged down in detail, and it's easy for us to read all sorts of things. We can read them clearly in the Standard. There's lots of them, Socialist Standard, for those of you that aren't members. But, you know, you can look at any newspaper, and I would challenge anyone to give me a newspaper, and I couldn't find half a dozen articles in any newspaper any day of any the Mail or the Times or the Guardian or the Telegraph, it wouldn't matter. There will be dozens of articles in there that give you problems that are trying to be solved under this system. And quite easily, if you swept aside the detail, the bottom line problem would be something to do with the economy. So the strange thing is why people can't see that. And I struggle with this. It's like a common denominator that comes up all the time. And it's a real struggle. You think, well, why don't people leave aside that the superfluous detail on top and think, well, what keeps appearing in all these problems? And it then is this thing called the economy, a money system that revolves around profit. And there is your problem. But unfortunately, that's what we've got to convey. And that's what's so difficult. Just look at a few of the things I hope you can see that we have to. And this is common knowledge to most people. This is not sort of, unusual stuff. But what do we have under capitalism? We have starvation, we have wars and environmental damage and social inequality. Only the other day I picked this up on the news, but we all know this stuff. It's not kind of, new rocket science or anything. But, this is Oxfam who are saying this as if it's something new. Let me just see if I can find the quote. Oh, this is Winnie Vianney-Armour, who's the Oxfam chief executive, but she's saying it's staggering that in the 21st century, half of the world's population, that's 3.5 billion people, own no more than a tiny elite whose numbers all fit comfortably on one double-decker bus. And of course, these are statistics that we all kind of know about, this massive inequality, and it's getting worse for those, better for some people, obviously, but worse for most people. And these statistics, you can look at this if you want, it makes you wonder why people who are as clever enough to run Oxfam and all this sort of thing don't think, well, what actually is the problem then? Why is it getting worse? And I'll come on to that later as well. Incidentally, I'm just going to touch on two books I've read briefly, but one of them I'll mention now. This book is by a lady called Caroline Wickham-Jones, who I actually met once up in Orkney. She's an archaeologist and a very, very, very clever woman. And she wrote this book called Fear of Farming. The title doesn't quite let you know what goes on in the book, but pretty much as an archaeologist, what she's writing about is societies over the years and how they've developed. So if anyone ever comes back to you and says, well, it's always been like this, well, you could present them with this book, and even if you didn't present them with the book, you could present them with the fact that actually that's not quite true. Even Christianity 2,000 years ago, that's 2,000 years ago, proper global capitalism had no way started then. Then you go back another 4,000 years and you've got the point when Neolithic farming began, basically. But something like 120 through the Mesolithic and Paleolithic times of humanity, before that, there were hunter-gatherer societies. So you can straight away demolish that argument and say, well, it hasn't always been like this. Not only that, it's sort of 114,000 years of different society. And another thing that's also is helpful is to try and get people around to the idea of thinking, well, we can change, we don't have to stay with a similar system. But of course, the difficulty we have is actually, dare I say it, capitalism is an extremely successful system in as far as, and by that I mean, it has a very good mechanism for holding itself in place. Okay, so that's, so starvation, 30, another statistic, and I don't want to bog, as I say, you don't want to get bogged down in statistics because most socialists are very familiar with all this, but 3.33% of children, all children in the world, die every year of starvation. The total number of people is over 7.5 million people a year will die of starvation, literally not enough food. And this is in a world, of course, of plenty. And the key question one has to ask, well, why is that? And in simple terms, they haven't got the money to buy the food. It's not the food doesn't exist, they haven't got the money. So there's that lowest common denominator creeping in again. They haven't got the money. So what does that tell you? It says you something wrong with a system that doesn't allow perfectly innocent children to have food. The other thing, war, of course, this is something that seems to be going on and on and on. And it's a clever thing that capitalism does because it conditions society to think that, these chaps are heroes or women now are heroes or heroines. And it's very clever. And you've got the health for heroes thing, which kind of you know, it gets people all jingoistic and all sort of behind this war effort, but it does not, at the end of the day, do anything about the complete and utter horror of war and having bits of your body torn apart and blown off by weapons. And of course, we all know that what's one of the biggest industries in the world, and why actually is it quite good to have war under capitalism? Simple terms, the arms industries go in, and boy, do they make a lot of money. And do we all know about sort of Hussein and all the various Pinochet governments and all the rest of them that have been armed by the West? It's big business. And of course, that is why people, why capitalism is so keen to promote it. It doesn't seem to feel too bad about people being blown aside. Incidentally, on the subject of war, UK soldiers, as far as I understand, American soldiers died from committing suicide from the trauma of being in a war zone than were killed by Afghan soldiers. The environment's the other big thing, of course, and this is something quite close to my heart. I've done some environmental work, but it is quite simply a byproduct of capitalism that the environment suffers, and it will go on suffering as long as it's profitable to cut down a tree. Even if there are no trees left, it will carry on. One thing I struggle with when I think about this is, why is it that politicians seem so kind of unable to engage with this particular problem? I can sort of understand why they do with the others in a funny sort of bizarre way. But they actually have children, and their children will be brought into this same world as our children and will have to live with the consequences of species decline and everything else. I don't really know why. I think they trot out all sorts of platitudes about why they, you know, they care about the environment. I think the bottom line is they're in the pockets of massive corporations, and I think they do as they're bid, basically. Some of you may know of Andrew Mitchell, who's the World Canopy CEO, I would imagine. And he said about the Amazon rainforest, he said, this is worth more felled than standing. Well, of course, by being worth more, he needless to say, he's talking in economic terms. But what tends not to get looked at in the environmental issues is what is really worth, you know, the worth to people, you know, the health benefits and the sheer pleasure of seeing all sorts of animals and plants and so on. I won't allude to Arctic trips, but I've mentioned one experience I've had when I was up in the Arctic. And there's a place called Fort Chipewyan, which is a tiny little village up in northern Canada. And in this village, there was a white Canadian doctor operating who looked after the village folk. It's not a massive place. I would imagine his responsibility covered 2,000 or 3,000 people. But he began to notice that cancer was on the increase massively, far more than the average, than what you would expect from a small town like this in Canada. And he began to investigate, and the bottom line was that the rivers were being polluted with all sorts of carcinogens, arsenic, and so on and so forth. And this was effluent from the factories that are up there mining. As you all know, as the Arctic ice melts, the mining companies are seeing this as a great opportunity to move in and exploit those lands. And we all know the cynical nature of capitalism, and that's what happens. But worse, he began to identify these problems and noticed that they were massively on the increase, and people were going about their normal lives, catching fish as they always did, and they were then getting cancers. He reported this, and surprise, surprise, you know, the mining company got terribly upset. And in a very short space of time, he was told that if he didn't shut up, he could push off. And as the last I heard, he had been pushed off when he disappeared. And they put a doctor in who wouldn't moan too much or say too much about these things. So this is the power of corporations. Massive mining companies will tread roughshod over the environment and people. And I don't think we should be under any illusion about how brutal that can be. You know, we had Rio Tinto in India doing some pretty dreadful stuff. As I say, I'm not going to pick out on things in detail because these are things that, frankly, anyone could look up. Just sort of Google Rio Tinto and you'll find it all. Now, social inequality. I mentioned the people on the bus thing. Capitalism requires growth, and all the existing parties of that are familiar to most people, the rights and lefts parties, you know, the Tories, the Liberals, Labour, and all the rest of them, they all pretty much, although they argue with each other, they're all basically running the same system. And when my daughter spoke to me a while back when Barack Obama became president of America, she said, oh, it's fantastic, you know, a black man is now president of America. And, you know, I think a black man should have every chance that any other person in the world should have. But I said, it won't make any difference. Exactly the same things will happen. And it has. It has made no difference whatsoever. You know, and what you find is these little win situations are, you know, to some people are good and it gives them a bit of a boost. And of course you had the black community in America throwing up the banners and everything else. But the bottom line is nothing's changed. And that is what people fail to realise, sadly. Now, I mentioned capitalism requires growth, and it requires growth at a cost, and it's rather like, it's a society, if you imagine a society living on a small island, and that society has a fire to keep warm and cook their food on, and half the island is a forest. Now, if you've got a system where you just want to keep that fire getting bigger and bigger and bigger, eventually you cut down the forest because you have to put more and more wood on because it's burning faster and consuming faster, and it's kind of, an exponential curve. And that's a simile, if you like. That's what it's like. And what we're finding at the moment is every single politician, left or right, whoever it is, always talks about growth. And frankly, growth comes at a price. It's like a house pot plant. You keep it growing, it will eventually use up the resources in that pot. You might want to pot it on. But in the case of a planet, you can't pot it on. You've only got limited resources. So eventually the system will change. It will have to change eventually. It cannot go on. But how it changes the thing. We'd all like socialism. And it's possible that lots of people will begin, maybe when it's too late, to understand that. The logic of capitalism is what I'd like to talk to now. This is interesting because capitalism has this great way of using certain devices to prolong its life. And this, I think, is interesting. The obvious one is religion. That's a big one. And in my view, I have lots of friends who are Christians and friends of all persuasions. But I kind of struggle with people that dress up in funny clothes and preach all sorts of strange ideas that are totally unproven. I discuss religion at huge length with many friends, and what I find is the bottom line. Some are extreme ends of religion and some are kind of mild, but the bottom line is they will say to you, you must have faith, and that is their default answer. And it comes up every time when you talk religion to anyone. It's you must have faith because they cannot prove anything and there is no tangible evidence. So therein lies a problem. But they will say, you cannot faith. If you haven't got faith, you know, I feel this. If you don't feel it, tough, sort of thing. But for capitalism, it's a great thing. It really is a great thing because it's kind of a crutch. And it sort of tells people that eventually it's all going to be all right if they tread the line of whichever religion they happen to agree with. Now, I think I don't want my comments about religion to be disparaging to the point where I'm being rude about people that have these beliefs, because everyone has different beliefs, whether they're pagans or humanists or have religious persuasions. And I think I have to be fair, a lot of people within a group broadly called religious sort of have the right idea about being kind to people, but it's kind of something that works within capitalism. But you know, you could be kind to people and have a great system without religion. And I think very often when you hear sermons preached on the radio, there's this great thing, and I've mentioned it in an article before, of saying we. And this word is just astonishes me, because you hear someone preaching a sermon, they always go, we must be kind to people, we must do this, we must do that. We think, well, who's this we? I mean, you know, individuals can do various things, but eventually it comes down to the society. It's something they'll say things like, we must not cut out all the rainforest. Well, you're not doing it personally. It's part of a massive, powerful system. And that's, forget the we, it's the society that's the problem here. So the other great thing, of course, about for capitalism is now coming back to this selfish gene thing that we talked of earlier. I absolutely don't believe that people are inherently selfish. And I think this comes up in conversation with people a lot. They, if you're arguing a point, some will say, oh, people are naturally selfish. It's nonsense. If it was true, then why do countless number of people do all sorts of altruistic things for other people? Why do they work for charities, the Wildlife Trust, the Oxfam, you know, Famine Trust, you name it, there's countless charities, and they all work for them, and they often unpaid voluntary work, often dangerous work, if you look at the Red Cross. And, you know, one has to think about these things, but for capitalism, charities are fantastic. I just put these up here, but I challenge anyone to tell me one of those is actually getting better as a result of these charitable acts that people do. The answer is none of them are. They're all getting worse, actually. And I mean, I talk to charitable people. I went up to a show, I can't remember what it was, and there was a stand for the Royal Society of Protection of Birds, I think it was. And, you know, these people are giving out leaflets. They're saying, oh, the curlew's declining, and what are we going to do? And, you know, farming sort of polluting the ground, and the rivers are doing this. And, you know, and you say, and you can't help but like these people, because at the end of the day, they're kind people, and they want to do good stuff, and it's fantastic. But they're not getting anywhere. So you're in this dual conversation with them saying, well, I think it's fantastic what you're doing, but you're wasting your time. And then you kind of make the socialist case. And again, you've got to tread carefully, because if you say something, you're wasting their time. They go, oh, you know, I don't like you talking to me like that. And it's very, you've got to be really careful. But which perhaps at this point, I might actually mention another technique that I would use in putting over the socialist case. And some of you may think that's daft. You haven't mentioned socialism. But I very often give talks to wildlife groups. And when I do so, I will put the whole socialist case over without mentioning the word. So I will tell them the problems, and I'll say how I perceive they could be solved. And almost to a person, they are totally behind you. If I had made it a political discussion, I have a feeling I'd meet with the anger again. But I don't do that. Now, I'm not sure that the socialists among you here will think that's a good or bad thing to do. I don't know. But I feel if you can put a case, you don't actually give them the name, and but you begin to develop these ideas, and they nearly all are highly, highly sympathetic. It's very interesting, actually. So, charities, great thing for capitalism. Resources. Resources result in all sorts of... obviously, they're declining. We all know that. You know, it's interesting at the moment that suddenly Britain, and even more bizarrely, America, are taking a huge interest in Crimea. You know, and again, you know, I remember as a school child, you hear about the Crimean War and so on, but you think, well, why now, why there? And unless I'm mistaken, I suspect there's an awful lot of resources that are very, whether it's gas coming across Crimea or whether there's a heavy metals or valuable metals, I don't know. As I say, I'd have to look into all that. But, you know, suddenly everyone's interested in Crimea and they're pretending it's the Ukrainian people they're concerned about. Well, I would say that's a bit of a nonsense. Mining, we've mentioned earlier, so I won't go into that hugely, but obviously mining can be hugely detrimental to the environment and people, indeed. If one looks at what went on in Chile in the early 70s when nitrates and gold and various other things were being mined in Chile, you've only got to read, and that might be a good idea to mention this book, you know, what happened to working people in Chile at that time, and it was mind-blowing. And for me, as someone who's brought up and born in England, to read about the workers in Chile, this is quite a good little book, actually, for those of you that are like me, who are perhaps not terribly academic, but it's done, oddly enough, in picture form. It only goes up to the mid-70s, unfortunately, and I'm now desperate to read another book that leads me into what happened after Pinochet. But great little book there, but, you know, another thing I might say about that is if anyone wants to at least contemplate the power of the working person, read what happened in Chile, because, you know, I'm not saying anything about it in detail, whether it worked or didn't or whatever, but it shows you the power of working people, and it's quite astonishing. I've forgotten where I was going with that now, but there we are. It's a good book, though, so anyone wants, if they give me an email, I'll give them it's a independently printed thing, so I'm not sure how easy it is to come by. Waste, well, we all know about waste. We're talking about resources now. You know, fashion. I have a particular thing against the fashion industry, personally. I really, you know, I'm not enamoured with it at all, but, you know, I shouldn't be unkind about people who like designing clothes, and I'm sure that's great. But so much of it is sold and then just chucked into landfill after a year, you know. And of course, the other thing about capitalism, fashion is a good example of this. If produce was made for use and it was well made, it would actually last quite a long time, a very long time. Even clothes would last a very long time. But, you know, why would capitalism want to do that? They want you to get rid of more and sell the latest brand of this, that or the other. And there's the key. So waste is a serious and obvious byproduct of capitalism. That is the thing. My picture there shows cars. And of course, now we travel great distances in cars, and they're wonderful things, actually. I mean, in terms of what they actually are. I mean, I'm not disputing the skill of designers and engineers here, but how you know, again, you look out of the window, most of the time you'll see a car like that, and there's one person in it. It's designed to take five people, that car. And almost everywhere you go, you'll see cars, less so London, admittedly, but you'll see cars with one person in. They're designed to take five. But they want one person to buy a car that takes five. They don't want five people to share that, because they're not going to sell, they're gonna sell fifth as many cars. So it's kind of obvious, isn't it? The media. Now, this is a great tool of capitalism. I put this picture in here because I just found it so annoying. This is a lady called Paris Hilton, who was just seriously irritating, this sort of stuff here. You know, this lady, this is Saint-Tropez Beach Club, and in one afternoon, she got her mates to spray £300,000 worth of champagne over her, because it felt like a bit of a buzz, and she had so much money. She thought, well, what else would I do with it, you know? And it's kind of this sort of disconnect I have with this sort of stuff. You think, well, you know, this is, you know, it's just almost obscene. Well, it is obscene. It's not almost obscene. It is. Anyway, so, but the media, the reason I sort of mention that is not to have a pop at her particularly, because in a way you can't really attack her any more than you can attack someone who's driving a huge 4x4, because people tend to do in capitalism what they can, and they kind of do what they think is, you know, right in their eyes. But it's a very powerful tool, the media, because it kind of makes people aspire, and it's convenient for capitalism, to all sorts of things that really, at the end of the day, don't do them a lot of good. For reality TV is an interesting one, because, you know, people look at reality TV, and very often you're shown slightly dysfunctional people. You know, Jeremy Kyle's show is an example, isn't it? Sort of, and they're so awful, and they're so dreadful, that you kind of think, well, actually, my life's not quite as bad because this stuff is so awful. And I think it's a very clever tool. So if you've got a really crappy job, you know, and you're stuck doing some awful thing all day, every day, and then you watch Jeremy Kyle and you see someone who's had such an awful life, they're sort of, you know, they've beaten up X number of wives and the wife clouts them around the head and they're drunk every night, and you think, well, actually, that's not too bad after all my life. It's a very clever thing. Anyway, so the media. Advertising. I don't know if you can see this over there, but this was an interesting thing. This, when I lived in Kent, I was near a place called Blue Water, and it's just a selling, obscene selling market, basically. You know, lots of stuff they're trying to sell you, and it's generally tacked. But there was a poster up here saying, buying for someone who has everything. Why not treat them to a Lakeside? You think, well, if they've got everything, do they really want a Lakeside gift card? But it just goes to show that even if you've got everything, they still want to sell you something else. And the important, the interesting thing about advertising is it sort of says itself what it, you know, what the problem is. You know, if someone was starving, would you advertise them food? Have to advertise food to them? The answer is no. Anyway, right. The actual capitalism as a profit system. I put this in because I think this is... I'm just going to jump back a bit here, because advertising... I wanted to mention something to you here that I thought was quite intriguing. Again, this shows the power of advertising. I don't know... I'm sure some of you will get this, but this is a little quiz now. If I say to you a few strap lines, I want... Just call out if you know what I'm talking about. Finger licking good. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, every little helps.
Right.
Tesco, yeah. It's the real thing.
Coke.
I'm loving it.
McDonald's.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, and there's this dog saying it.
Oh, well.
What is it? Yeah, Churchill. That's it. Well done.
Yes. Yeah, well done.
Yeah. You're really conditioned, aren't you? Happiness is...
Hampshire.
Oh, no, that was... I was. Is A. I'll extend on that a bit. You must be old enough to remember that. I can't be the only... Oh, I was going to say cigar called Hamlet. Oh, so their marketing campaign wasn't a lot of good, obviously. Just Do It. Does anyone know that one?
Heard it.
Yankee?
No, Nike. Oh, yeah. Now that's interesting. That could be the demographic in the age group here, because we don't all buy Nike trainers, do we? Has anyone got Nike trainers on? No, that could be that. What that is. And lastly, probably.
Carlsberg.
Oh yeah, you're old Alky. Yeah. Anyway, so the point I'm making. The thing is, you're too strong-minded to be conditioned, a lot of you. I suspect if I'd kind of thrown that into a sort of bunch of 20-year-olds, they would have been on it. Anyway, so let's move on. From the profit system, the ludicrous nature of a system that relies on profit is shown, I think, by these next two slides. Now, one of those pictures I'm going to show you now is Ugg boots. And one of them, and I've just changed it, in case you're wondering, the other one isn't. But the point I want to make about this particular thing was, that's a brand, and people buy into brands. At the end of the day, they're rather clumpy, bizarre-looking suede boots. That's all they are. But it's a very important brand, and if you've got UGG written on it, you can sell them for a lot more, and so on and so forth. I mentioned this particular one. It's just one of many countless brands, and then these people that buy into them, and you know, they wear Jack Wills t-shirts made by some poor slave somewhere. They don't, you know, they buy into all this nonsense. But there was a lady who was on the news a few years ago, and forgive me if I've mentioned this to some of you before, but she brought a pair of UGG boots for her daughter, ostensibly thinking she had the real UGG boots. She didn't, and they were stopped at customs, and she never got them. So she paid for a pair of UGG boots for her daughter. She never received them. And the pair that she bought, along with thousands of others that they impounded, were burnt. So that's one of the great things about capitalism. You can have perfectly serviceable boots, but they'll be burnt if they can't be sold at a profit by the brand that makes them. So, you know, if anyone starts to say, well, actually, I think capitalism is a sensible society. You know, you can run these things by them and think, are you sure? Well, tell me why that's sensible. It's rather like when I was a kiddie and seeing Mountains of Cauliflowers. Do you remember that? And it was a thing on the news, and it really struck me even then, before I came across socialism, someone had started pinching these cauliflowers. And there was a pile of them. They weren't being sold because they couldn't be sold at a profit because of the markets. So they sprayed them with kerosene so no one could steal them and eat them. You know, it speaks for itself, doesn't it? You don't really have to argue it. It argues itself so well. Health, safety and pollution. Well, of course, you know, we all know about the things that are going on in the world in that respect, and I'm not going to try and highlight anything particular. But, you know, a lot of this stuff, health and safety and pollution. Pollution, I know from my own experience of talking to scientists up in the north, as soon as the inspectors have left the factory, they literally think, oh, yeah, she's gone, right, chuck the arsenic into the river again. And basically this is happening all over the place. You know, people aren't put first, and certainly the environment, you know, workers will die doing all sorts of things, and the environment is dying as a result. So we all know about this stuff. Energy and biofuels. Well, of course, you know, this idea that we're going to sort of grow all this wonderful sort of palm oil, suddenly it sort of got slightly different because, you know, as a result of burning this palm oil for this all-consuming requirement, vast tracts of forest are being cleared and all sorts of bio ecosystems are being destroyed. The next picture I want to show you is a picture I took in the Arctic, and as I promise you, only one picture, sorry, there are two, but it doesn't look like the Arctic, does it? But this was somewhere up in northern Canada, and it struck me that I just had a conversation with someone, and there was a small settlement where the Canadian government were really getting extremely hot under the collar because they had to bring in a little plane to take this little Inuit lady, who must have been about 85, out of the settlement to hospital. And they didn't like doing this. And it's often happening in the Arctic and a lot of Aboriginal cultures over the whole world. Big governments try and corral them into one area, whether it's a reserve in Canada or some of the towns in
the Arctic ore reserves and so on in Australia. They try and corral them so they can be controlled. They don't want to spend money flying a little poor lady for some medical treatment to Alberta or something, because it's going to cost a lot of fuel in that plane to do that. And that's a pain in the arse. So, interestingly though, they are extremely happy to fly sugary water all over the Arctic, thousands of miles, or pizzas. All this is processed food, and that is literally tins of sugary, rubbishy water. But they make a lot of profit out of that, and that's why they do it. But the byproduct is children in the Arctic are getting terrible diabetes, terrible dental conditions, and grossly obese. So that's the price. But who cares? They're buying it. It doesn't matter. Another one you may have heard of, if any of you have got access, well, I suppose most people do these days to the internet, there's a film, and forgive me, I can't remember who made this film, but it's called The End of the Line. And basically, it talks about fishing. It's not a political film, but it deals with aspects of fishing and the aspects of how the oceans are being depleted of food. Now, I may need some help with you on this, but I think I know what it is. That is a bluefin tuna. And bluefin tuna is a threatened species. It is one of the most beautiful sea animals there are. It's a beautiful fish. And Mitsubishi, who I always thought just made cars, but they don't. Apparently, they also buy up bluefin tuna and freeze it. And the reason they're doing this is because as it's verging on extinction, once they've frozen that, it's like a hedge fund. They are going to make a fortune out of it when it actually becomes extinct. And I think, forgive me, I'm don't know a huge amount about economy, but does that mean yen? I think it might well do. Okay, well, there you are. That's what the little picture says there. You know, Mitsubishi fishing the bluefin tuna and making vast, vast profits. So take a look at the film. It's called The End of the Line. Right, coming to the end now, you may be pleased to know. Just one last picture there. This again to me, and it's not rocket science, and I haven't dwelt on lots of individual things, but this again says a lot, really. The idea of an everlasting bowl, this is a low-energy bowl, but I think the analogy is rather similar in some respects. But the everlasting bowl was invented many, many, many years ago. So one could say, well, why don't we have them? And the obvious answer is because once they're made, they are by definition everlasting, and so you wouldn't buy another one. So in capitalism, it's not in the interest of the manufacturer to make an everlasting bulb. They'd much rather use more resources and make lots of bulbs that get thrown into landfill and so on and so forth. You see the logic. I mean, it's such simple stuff. And this is where, I'm coming to the end now, this is where when I talk to people, sometimes I feel terribly frustrated because they say, well, yeah, but you've got to sell this stuff. You say, yeah, but you haven't really, because if you had a different system, you wouldn't be compelled to sell endless things and have built-in obsolescence and so on and so on and so on. But the struggle is, in my conversation with a lot of people, they just, not being unkind, but they just don't get it. They'll talk to you, but they'll be talking, as I said, with this capitalist conditioning. So, well, you'd still have to sell them, though, wouldn't you? You think, well, no, you wouldn't, because there wouldn't be this, maybe it's just I'm a lousy communicator of ideas, but we do have to think how we argue with people, because I think this is really very, very important. Just to finish, I'd like to mention a few people and a little scenario for you that have come up recently. Obviously, we had the protest movement fairly recently, as you know, and I was with my daughters in Bath, I think it was, and there was a bit of an encampment in one of the squares in Bath. So always keen for a bit of a chin wag with people. I thought, well, I must go and actually talk to them and see, you know, what that's all about. And perhaps they'd gone, but there was half a dozen still there, and you know, there was one sitting outside the tent, and they, you know, they don't do themselves a huge amount of favours because they're sort of staggering around with a special brew in their hand. And I said, oh, you know, interesting, what's the protest movement about? And frankly, they had no idea. He didn't know, this chap, what they were protesting about. I think he's just terribly angry, as a lot of these movements tend to be. It's, oh, well, we should get more wages, or, you know, we're sick of unemployment, or we're sick of this, or sick of that. But they don't have an answer, and therein lies a problem. And this is where I think socialism has got an answer. And this is why I think socialists, you know, are actually and can be extremely eloquent in dealing with the problem. But it is how we argue this case. Recently, as you, also, we have other interesting characters. I mentioned a few here. I scratched them down in my notes. Russell Brand, obviously, we came up recently. And I kind of read that, and I thought, well, I sort of quite liked what he said, and I have to say I really didn't like him as a person particularly before. But I found myself with a lot of empathy when I heard what he said, but sadly he still didn't seem to have that end answer, that idea of an entire system change. Jeremy Hardy, who those of you who listen to is the sort of token Radio 4 lefty, and I think a lot of his ideas, although maybe allegorical or slightly disguised at times, not always, I have to say, but I think the problem he has is rather like Russell Brand. They're both comedians, and so they're kind of tolerated by the media as being a bit, you know, oh, they're those bloody lefties, you know, they're funny guys and so on and so forth. And actually that doesn't help their cause, because you could ask, you know, they may not have the same ideas exactly as socialists, but, you know, they're in the right area. And but the trouble is, of course, they're sort of tolerating thrown on to Radio 4 rather like the token any other minority person might be thrown on there. Lastly, I threw in George Monbiot, because I had an email conversation a while back now with George Monbiot, and I read a reasonable amount of his writings. But again, I think he's the sort of person I admire for his concern, particularly about the environment and everything else, but also another example of someone who wants to try and reform a system or make things work within a system that is so obviously designed not to make those things worse. Right, I just want to finish now, thanks ever so much for listening, on one little sort of analogy that one might think of in terms of what it actually means to be a working person. In some respects, I'm fortunate because I worked as a tree surgeon, and I have a small company, which is a tree surgeon surgery company. It's not Monsanto, it's not ICI, it's a very small little company, but that is what I do. I have a tree surgery company. And before you all think that I'm just going to get picked up by my chauffeur in a minute and sworn off somewhere, that's not the case. But what I would say about, you know, the chaps I work with, an interesting thing is, you may remember a few years ago, RBS paid their fat cat people £1 billion bonus. I'm sure you remember this. Now, interestingly, the same year, they made a £1 billion loss, which struck me as rather bizarre, but they did. They made £1 billion loss, but also in the same year, they paid £1 billion bonus. And we all know the banking arguments. You know, you've got to have the right people, otherwise they leave and they have to be paid this money, and so on and so forth. Now, if our guys, and there's 25 people, tree surgeons in this little business, if we had worked to pay that bonus for 1 year for those few people that work for that one company, we would have had to, all 25 of us, come over with William the Conqueror, work solidly since then, and not spent a penny of our salaries ourselves, put the whole lot into a bank, and only last year would we have had enough money to pay that 1 year's bonus for those people. Now, if you think that's bad, this year, as we all know, our dear old friend Putin decided that he wanted to sort of snazz up the Olympics a bit, so they had the Winter Olympics. Now, that Olympic Games, I'm not saying that having a pop at sports people here or anything like that, and I think it's great fun for people to get together and, you know, play a bit of ice hockey and do a bit of skiing. Oh, that's great. I don't have a problem with people having fun together. But just get a picture of this one. I mentioned coming over with William the Conqueror. If our same little company had had to go up there chopping wood, dragging brushwood around, working extremely hard, we would have had to have worked since Paleolithic times to earn the money for that one Olympic Games. Paleolithic times, okay? So to give you an idea, that's 31,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, Christianity started. 6,000 years ago,
farming started with Neolithic people. So you're actually going back 25,000 years before that. So those 25 guys would have had to work since then on their current salaries, I hasten to add, to earn only this year enough to set that one Olympic Games off the ground. So that sort of gives you an idea of the money that's swimming around in capitalism, but who actually gets it? Anyway, thanks ever so much.